The Microbit Playground Survey. Right, it's Nick Bright in for Gordon. Then we've got a little bit more with regards to what's happening in the Middle East for you. Plus the Five Live Amnesty is in the way. Our Monday musicologist as well after midnight. But right now, at 11 o'clock, let's get the latest BBC News.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News, that's 11 o'clock. This is Matthew Carter. There's mounting evidence that Israel is preparing to launch a ground offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Tanks have been massing on Israel's northern border, with three areas being declared closed military zones. Witnesses have reported hearing huge consecutive blasts in a southern suburb of the capital, Beirut. The Israeli military warned residents there to evacuate ahead of planned strikes on Hezbollah targets. US officials have given a briefing to reporters in Washington, from where Tom Bateman reports.
Referring to Israeli ground operations into Lebanon, the State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said the Israelis had told them about a number of operations, describing these as limited and focused on Hezbollah infrastructure near the border. Asked by the BBC about whether Washington's repeated calls for restraint over the past fortnight had been ignored by Israel, Mr. Miller said Israel was justified to kill Hassan Nasrallah, the Hezbollah leader.
The UK has announced that a chartered commercial flight will leave Beirut on Wednesday to help any British nationals wanting to leave Lebanon. US Homeland Security fear as many as 600 people may have lost their lives in the wake of severe flooding in the southeastern United States. Hurricane Helene brought havoc to Florida's Gulf Coast on Thursday before moving into Georgia, North and South Carolina, Tennessee and Virginia. The former Homeland Security advisor, Lars Anderson, fears the number of fatalities could be much higher.
I don't think we know the full scale yet. I think there are a lot of communities that are still cut off. Communication lines are not solid, and so people don't really know what the full scale of this is yet. That's why the U.S. government has teams. That's why states have teams going in trying to establish those lines of communication and really getting help to those who need it.
Experts are appealing for people to come forward if they think their relatives might have been buried at a mother and baby home in the Republic of Ireland. A decade ago, it emerged that the nuns who ran the site at Tuam in County Galway between the 1920s and 60s had disposed of the remains of nearly 800 babies and young children in a disused sewage tank. A new excavation is aiming to identify the victims. The head of the civil service, Simon Case, has said he'll leave the role at the end of the year, citing health issues. Mr. Case was appointed 4 years ago, but recent reports suggested tension between him and the new Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Sue Gray. Sir Keir Starmer thanked him for his service to the country. The minimum price of a unit of alcohol has gone up in Scotland for the first time since 2018. The rise from 50 to 65 pence per unit means a can of lager will cost at least £1.30. Tom Bennett, a recovering alcoholic who works with the support group the Scottish Recovery Consortium, says the money raised should help to fund treatment services.
In my own experience, there was little to no help. It was, sorry, you got yourself into this problem, it's up to you to get yourself out. Things have moved on ever so slightly since then, but alcohol has been off the government's radar for a long time now, and we really need to get it back on where we're investing in services so that people get the appropriate support.
And that's the BBC News. It's 3 minutes past 11.
If you love your pop, this is right up your street.
Pop Top 10 with Scott and Rylan.
We've picked some of the most hotly contested questions of all time and decided to settle them once and for all with the help of some special guests. We're taking it very seriously.
I can't let things like that slide on this show.
No, come on!
What are you on about?
Don't put words into my mouth.
Oh, right? I'm darling, you're spatting them yourself.
Search Pop Top 10 to listen on BBC Sounds.
Weeknights with Nick Bright.
Yeah, welcome back to the show tonight. Still to come, we'll be doing our final Five Live Amnesty, where we all share our embarrassing stories and find comfort and forgiveness amongst the late night community. So if you've had a truly mortifying moment that you want to finally lay to rest, then 85058 is the number. Send me a text, why not? And comedian Laura Davis will be joining me to share a few of the terrible clangers she's dropped in her storied past. After midnight, it's the musicologist Dr. Joe Bennett with another deep dive into the secrets behind great music. We've already explored things like the mystery of pentatonic scales and the secrets behind great duets. Tonight, it's all about the songs that caused a stir and the songs that got banned. Why were they so controversial and how did it affect their success? Well, Dr. Joe will be with us just after midnight. But first, we're going to stay with the big international story this evening. In the last hour, explosions have been heard in the suburbs of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, after Israel warned a wider military incursion into the country may be imminent. The Israeli Defense Force has carried out a series of airstrikes and smaller scale operations inside Lebanon in the last fortnight as they target members of the Hezbollah group, which have been firing rockets across the border since the conflict in Gaza began. Around 1,000 people have been killed in the last 2 weeks in Lebanon, according to official figures. A short time ago, I spoke to our Middle East correspondent, John Donison, and he gave us the latest.
They have been reinforcing the number of troops and military equipment up on that border, but they don't have the same amount of forces up there ready yet as they did, for example, in 2006 when there was a full-scale invasion of Lebanon during the war between Israel and Hezbollah. But it may be that they are approaching things differently. I think what they will likely face, though, is stiff resistance, because while much of Hezbollah's leadership has been decimated in recent days, well, the Iranian-backed group still maintains tens of thousands of heavily armed, well-trained fighters. Many of them fought in the civil war in Syria, and they will have been preparing for an Israeli invasion for years, frankly.
The UK Foreign Secretary David Lammy has tonight repeated his call for an immediate ceasefire. He's been speaking to his US counterpart, Antony Blinken.
We both agreed the position that we had at the UN last week, that the best way forward is an immediate ceasefire and to get back to a political solution. And we both are urging de-escalation at this time.
Tanks have been massing on Israel's northern border and three areas there have been declared closed military zones. The Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary, Sabrina Singh, explained what Washington knew of Israel's planned operations in Lebanon.
We understand what they're doing along that northern border is conducting limited operations to dismantle Hezbollah infrastructure. What the secretary continues to urge for is to seek a diplomatic solution. We certainly want to see regional tensions cool. We see that the best path forward is through diplomatic means, and so that's what we're continuing to push for.
Well, let's bring in Jonathan Marcus, the BBC's former defence and diplomatic correspondent. Evening, Jonathan.
Yes, good evening, Nick.
So your reaction, firstly, then, to what we're hearing tonight, a ground incursion either taking place or imminent in some form?
Yes, I mean, certainly it looks as though Israeli troops have been across the border already in a number of places, carrying out reconnaissance and raids. All the indications are that larger forces will follow, perhaps overnight. We hear significant reports of significant bombardment going on across the border into Lebanon. Obviously, also continuing strikes on the area which is seen as Hezbollah's main center of gravity in the southern part of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. So all the indications are of some kind of ground operation. But what you heard there from my former colleague, you know, the Americans, as far as we know, have been told that this will be a limited ground operation. But of course, once it gets underway and once there is some kind of contact between Israeli forces and Hezbollah fighters on the ground, it's then, of course, much harder to predict the course of any future military operations.
You mentioned America there, actually, you know, traditionally Israel's biggest ally. Is there any sense that the US has any bearing on what is and will be potentially happening? You know, what did you make of President Biden's comments earlier?
Well, the Americans have obviously, on the one hand, offered Israel significant support for the past year, and obviously are long-standing allies of Israel. But clearly, between Mr. Netanyahu and the American president, there isn't a great deal of love lost. Mr. Biden, to many people, appears a kind of lame duck president, and I think nowhere is that clearer than in the Israeli attitude towards him. The problem, of course, is that Israel is fighting in Hezbollah, a group that is a sworn enemy of the United States as well. The United States, like Britain, regards Hezbollah as a thoroughly bad set of people. Americans have died at Hezbollah's hands in the past. So it's very complex, you know, to an extent. Israel argues that it's fighting this war on the part of the West. And whilst one wouldn't, you know, want to 100% agree with that, there is an element of truth in that statement as well.
So just in terms of diplomacy, I guess, and the influence of America and the West when it comes to ceasefires, is that something that's unlikely to happen now?
Well, I don't think there's going to be anything like a ceasefire that thwarts whatever is going to take place. Obviously, Israel has struck at Hezbollah's leadership on a really significant scale. It believes that it has tipped the balance in its favor, and it's seeking to, you know, exact whatever price it can on Hezbollah as it reels from these assaults on its leadership. The crucial question here, and it's a question that the Israeli government has in many ways failed in the Gaza operation, is how you turn military advantage into political and diplomatic success. After all, Israel's goal is not to invade Lebanon. Israel's goal is to push back Hezbollah, to try and get Lebanese authority extended down to the south of the country, and thus to enable Israeli citizens in the northern part of that country to return to their homes without the daily threat of bombardment from Hezbollah rockets and missiles. Now, you can only do so much in military terms. That then has to be transferred into a political and diplomatic endgame. And that's what Mr. Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, has found impossible, and perhaps he's unwilling to do in Gaza. And if he's going to have a success in this operation in the north into Lebanon, he needs to find a way of getting that political and diplomatic victory. And to do that, he needs his allies, and above all, he needs the United States.
And on the other side, I guess, what tactics do you think Iran is deploying in all of this?
Well, it's interesting, because when the Israelis and Hezbollah last fought in 2006, that was, for many people, it was seen as the sort of first round in a wider struggle between Iran and Israel. Iran makes no secret of its desire to eradicate Israel, to see it disappear from the map. And the strategy it's pursued has been to try and develop this, what it calls this ring of fire around Israel, a whole range of close allies of Tehran who are willing to bring their fire to bear on Israel in certain circumstances. Hamas was a member of that alliance, if you want to call it that. The Houthis in Yemen are part of it. And of course, the jewel in the Iranian crown was Hezbollah, a force that is essentially an army. I mean, it's the strongest military player inside Lebanon. It is, for all intents and purposes, an army with properly formed, properly trained units. It has an extraordinary missile force, obviously somewhat depleted now, but it was so large, I doubt that, you know, a huge dent has been placed in its missile stocks. And the crucial thing about Hezbollah is that it was, in a sense, Iran's first line of defense against Israel. Iran, aware that its nuclear program is a potential target for Israeli strikes and so on. So everybody's looking to see what Iran might do. All the indications are so far that Iran is going to be very, very cautious indeed. The Israeli Prime Minister, Mr. Netanyahu, offered this a speech on social media directly to the Iranian people. We don't know how many of them would necessarily have been able to catch it because that particular social media site is banned in Iran, but I'm sure many people do have access to it by other means. And he spoke directly to the Iranian people, arguing that Israel and Iran were not enemies, that it was essentially the regime in Iran that was the problem. And I think that is a sort of, you know, an implicit warning to the Iranians, and the Americans have made it very clear to the Iranians as well that if they decide to launch some direct attack against Israel, then Israel's response is going to be very significant. And I think just as the Hezbollah operation was remarkably infiltrated by the Israelis, and they seem to have extraordinary knowledge of who was meeting and when and so on, there are clear indications that it has a significant level of knowledge about what is going on inside Iran too. And I think that will give Iranian leaders cause for thought. I think that whole axis is reeling at the moment. It's very much off balance. The Israelis are clearly eager to press home that advantage militarily as far as they can. But as I say, there is no ultimate military answer. It can set the framework for a settlement, but ultimately you have to be willing to pick the diplomatic chestnuts, if you like, out of the fire.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you very much for your time this evening. Jonathan Marcus, the BBC's former defence and diplomatic correspondent. We'll bring you any significant updates in Lebanon as soon as they happen tonight, of course. And Dotton will keep you across major updates as well in the early hours of the morning. He arrives at 1. Still to come on the show, of course, our midnight musicologist Dr. Joe returns with another deep dive into one area of music in particular tonight. It's controversial songs, you know, the ones that made waves, but also the ones that got banned. And Dr. Joe will be with us in the next half an hour to give us a rundown of what to expect and kick off the weekly music quiz as well. For now, let's return to another story that's been making headlines today. This one's about the BBC's Strictly Come Dancing. The actress Amanda Abington says she feels vindicated by the findings of a BBC review of the complaints she made about her Strictly Come Dancing partner, Giovanni Panice. She previously accused him of being abusive, cruel and mean during their rehearsals for the show last year. He has always denied the claims. The BBC's review upheld some of Amanda Abington's complaints, but cleared Giovanni of the most serious allegations. Charlotte Moore is the BBC's chief content officer.
So I want to apologise to Amanda that she did not have a positive experience on Strictly. Obviously, you know, one has to remember over the 20 years, you know, of Strictly's lifetime, you know, this has been a positive experience for the majority of people who've been on Strictly. So I do want to apologise on behalf of the BBC to Amanda, and I also want to thank her for having the courage to come forward. You know, this is not an easy thing to do, to come forward and to make a complaint, a formal complaint. I think, you know, I do want to thank her for that. But at the same time, I do need to be really clear that this is a confidential process, so I'm not able to go into the specifics.
Now, earlier, our entertainment correspondent, Lizo Mazimba, spoke to Johnny Iantson on 5 Live.
Well, the BBC put out a statement earlier today, and all they really said in quite a lengthy statement, getting to the centre of the issue, is saying, we've assessed the complaints made by Amanda Abington, and we have upheld some, but not all, of the complaints made. We want to apologise to Amanda Abington and to thank her for coming forward and taking part. We know this would not have been an easy thing to do. Now, as I was just saying, only some of the complaints were upheld. The BBC understands that the complaints that were upheld involved verbal bullying and harassment, but complaints about physical aggression were not upheld. Amanda Abington issued a statement earlier today and she said, I've never regretted coming forward, and today's apology from the BBC is a vindication of my complaint. It's not just a vindication for me, it's a vindication for the other people who've contacted me since I made my complaint to express concerns about their own experiences on Strictly Come Dancing. I hope those who felt unable to speak out now will be more confident they'll be listened to and believed. We've also had a statement from Giovanni Panice. He said, I'm glad the review has finally come to an end. I'm relieved that the allegations that I was threatening and abusive were found not to be true. The majority of the false allegations have been thrown out by the review. It's been an extremely difficult year reading story after story and not being able to say anything in return, as I respected the integrity of the review, which the BBC asked everyone to do. So yes, you know, both sides in a way trying to claim victory, but I think the fact remains, and the headline is that 6 complaints, including complaints about verbal bullying and harassment, were upheld against Giovanni Panice. And I think that's behaviour that everyone recognises is not permissible in the workplace, in any workplace.
I haven't heard the full interview with Charlotte Moore, the BBC's chief content officer, but there was a talk for a long time in the lead up to this about the videotapes that apparently the BBC have kept of the sessions, the rehearsal sessions, and many people saying, well, look, wouldn't it all just be put to bed if they released a video and everybody could see what had happened? Was there any talk of those at all?
Well, yes, but Charlotte Moore was very keen to emphasise that they can't go into detail about the investigation. They can't go into things that impinge on the confidentiality of the actual investigation and people's private information. And as we've seen going forward, the BBC have said that in the future they will have individual chaperones in all of the training sessions right throughout the week. We don't know quite what happened in the past, if everything was videoed or not.
And finally, Lizzo, the show's underway. There was no mention of it at any point during the show, I think, certainly the opening episode. Is that it? Is it put to bed now, do you think? Will the show be able to move on without more conversations around this?
I think so. I think the BBC will be keen to separate out the show itself as a piece of entertainment and the story about this report, which has been, waited for many, many weeks and quite a few months now. I'd be very surprised if they made any kind of reference to it on the show, because the show, what they want to do is just say, we want to entertain people with this incredibly popular show celebrating its 20th year. Anything about talking about this report summary that's come out today, I can't see any advantage to the BBC in drawing more attention to it by talking about it on Strictly on Saturday night.
That was our entertainment correspondent, Lizzo Mazimba, speaking to Johnny Anton on 5 Live Drive a little bit earlier on. Right, for the last time then, we're going to get cosy and conspiratorial with the 5 Live Amnesty. So this is a chance for you to share your embarrassing stories, so maybe something that you're even maybe a little bit ashamed about, and let our brilliant late night community provide a bit of comfort, commiseration, and maybe even absolution. Who knows? So if you have a tale for consideration, a moment that you've wronged someone, or someone maybe they've wronged you, get in touch. You can text us 85058 or 08085 909 693 if you want to give us a call or a WhatsApp message. Now, bravely putting themselves up for judgment this week is an award-winning comedian, writer and director, Laura Davis. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
Lovely.
Thank you for having me.
No, lovely to have you with us. So first things first, how have you been? What have you been up to? Tell me everything.
Been pretty good. Just finished out of my Fringe the other month and had some shows in London. Been sitting on trains, eating my meal deals, thinking about what snacks to get from the Tesco.
Do you know, I've never been to the Fringe, and it's something that I want to put right every year, but then I see the cost of accommodation and I'm like, oh.
See, that's why I moved to Edinburgh, because it works out to being about, I think it's 1 in 3 weeks are free.
You're better off renting your place out and just sleeping in a tent during the Fringe.
Yeah.
You'll make so much money.
There's definitely people camping this year. It's been a huge thing, all these, tent communities.
Yeah, right.
Of improvisers popping up over the place.
Maybe I'll join them next year. You were performing your show, Albatross.
Yes.
How did it go?
It went well. I was really, really happy with the work, and Monkey Barrel is such a great venue. It's definitely a nice little hub to be in.
Yeah, and off the back of Fringe, is it working on something new, or are you touring this material? How does it work?
Definitely people have started asking about next year's show, which
already?
Is three is really it's really intense to start the cycle again, but trying to start as many projects as possible while the window's still open, basically.
Of course, you got to strike while the iron's hot in this business, you know.
Absolutely. Good. Then, on the weekends, got all those stag do's to entertain. That's my favourite thing to do. Just catch the train, go out, ruin a stag do, and then come back on the late one.
I mean, I think stag do's pretty much ruin themselves, to be honest with you, but hey-ho.
Yeah, you're cutting out the middleman.
Right, let's talk then. What are you seeking forgiveness for, Laura? Because this is a condensed amnesty, and it's the last one as well,
Yeah, I've got quite a short one. This one, I think it should be straightforward because I'd almost forgotten about it. My brother kept bringing it up this last couple of years, which is that when we were kids and we were in the backyard pool, which doesn't make you wealthy in Australia, by the way. It's an important thing to say to the British audience.
Yeah, right.
So there's 5 years between us. I would have been about 11. He would have been about 6. And to sort of keep him out of the swimming pool so I could sort of have it to myself, I used to tell him there was a shark in the pool and then he would be too scared to come in. And he kept bringing it up earlier this year. Genuinely, it's a bit of a mean thing to do. I feel like maybe my saving grace might be 6, might just be the age where you could start applying some reasoning skills and go, well, I can't see a shark in the pool and my sister's not being eaten, so there's probably not a shark in the pool.
So hang on, wait, I need to get a few facts straight here. So he was 6 and you were how old?
11.
You're on the edge here. I'm not going to let you. You're on the edge of. You're on the edge of like you should know better.
Yeah, I'm old enough to know better. My argument is, I think he is also old enough to know better in that story.
Yeah, I mean, you make a fair point. I mean, it's not.
Sharks
it's not,
don't live in the pool.
They don't live in the swimming pool, and also it's not as if water isn't clear. I mean, you can see the bottom.
Crystal, you can see. He used to say, well, why can't I see it? He says it's hiding in the filter box, which is about maybe, 20 square centimetres.
How small is this shark?
I mean, exactly.
Be able to nibble your finger at best. How long did this go on for? Was it something that carried
on?
I probably
got 18 months out of it before he really decided probably it was safe to go back in the water.
18 months. That's quite naughty though,
We live quite a way inland.
Right.
About an hour drive to the beach, about 50 kilometres.
What's that in relation to? How far a shark would have to travel to get to your swimming pool?
Yeah, for how lost it would have to be.
Right. And has he developed a phobia of swimming pools since, or has he got over it?
He's all good. He's all good. He's in Queensland, which is, just seeking the sharks out at that point.
I mean, I feel like you may have robbed him of his chances of being, an Olympic swimmer. Because let's be honest, Australians...
It is a formative age.
I mean, but in Australia, you guys are pretty good at the swimming,
There's a lot of stuff we have to be able to outpace.
Yeah, predominantly sharks in your backyard swimming pools, if your sister
sharks.
Is mean.
Yeah, it would be more logical for there to be a snake or something in there. Occasionally there was a frog, but that's about the only thing that ever made it in there.
Do you know what? Because I've got to be the decision maker here because it's just me and you. I like it. Maybe I shouldn't because I'm the youngest of 3 boys. So I was always the one who was the butt of a joke. I was always, I would have been your brother in this scenario. But I like it and I am going to forgive you. It's the last ever amnesty. So I am going to forgive you for this. You are forgiven.
Thank you.
You are forgiven.
What a relief.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if your brother would feel the same way. Let's find out. He's on the line now. No, he's not. We don't.
Oh, no.
We don't have him on the line. But yeah, I'm forgiving you for that. But you've got a quick second story, I believe, as well.
Yes, it is. This one is more difficult. This I have not yet been able to forgive my husband for, which is during the Fringe a couple of years ago, he came back from having dinner at his friend's place and he said, I've brought a cheese platter for you. They sent some back home with me. I've wrapped it all up. And it was all cheese and crackers wrapped up in tin foil. And he said, oh, there's some special cakes there as well for later. Uh-oh. If you want them. And I go, no, not for me. I don't mess around with no special cakes. And then I got about 3/4 of the way through the cheese platter and he came in and he said, no, you didn't eat those cakes, did you? I said, no, I didn't eat the cakes. Just the cheese platter that you said was for me. And he said, oh, no, the oat cakes. Uh-oh. So these little rosemary oat cakes had been laced quite strongly with THC and I was on stage about 2 hours later.
No.
In front of about 450 people, And yeah, in some of the many lifetimes I lived in between then and getting off stage, I think in one of them I decided to forgive him, but back in this one, I'm not quite sure.
Right. So
there was no warning. And he did say, here's a cheese platter for your dinner.
How did the show go? That's the question.
Oh, the worst part about it, it was fine. Look, I'm very good at what I do sometimes. I managed to get through. The most difficult part was there was a big stag do in the front and they were all in fancy dress. Oh. So it was just a lot of policemen, a bit like a corporate gig I would never have agreed to. Just dog catchers, firefighters.
Is it a stag do or are they here to arrest me? I can't quite work it out, you know?
So many cops in the front row.
I'm going to say, because you're a comedian and it makes a great story, I say forgive again. I'm
all
feeling
right.
That is a loophole,
isn't it?
Yeah, you're a comedian. It makes a great story. So forgive for me. Well, listen, Laura, it's short and sweet, but it's been absolutely brilliant speaking
to
you. Before you go, though, I'm sure there'll be lots of people who want to check you out. Is there somewhere they can find your stuff, maybe come and see you?
Absolutely. Find all my stuff on social media, which is Laura Davis Comic, and you can watch the whole show that's up on YouTube at the moment. If you just search my name, it'll come up. It's not lost.
Done. It's quite easy to work out. Well, listen, Laura, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That is Laura Davis, who's double forgive. Well, Laura's been forgiven, but Laura's husband has also been forgiven at the same time. There you go. Bang on time. Look at that. Who'd have thought? It's almost like we planned it. It is 11:30. Let's get the latest Five Live news. Here's Nick Hatton.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Nick, thank you. There is mounting evidence that Israel is preparing to launch a ground offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Tanks have been massing on Israel's northern border, with three areas being declared closed military zones. Witnesses have reported hearing huge consecutive blasts in a southern suburb of the capital, Beirut. The Israeli military warned residents there to evacuate ahead of planned strikes on Hezbollah targets. Meanwhile, the UK has announced that a chartered commercial flight will leave Beirut on Wednesday to help any British nationals wanting to leave Lebanon. US Homeland Security fear as many as 600 people may have lost their lives in the wake of severe flooding in the southeastern United States. Hurricane Helene brought havoc to Florida's Gulf Coast on Thursday before moving into Georgia, northern South Carolina, Tennessee and Virginia. And experts are appealing for people to come forward if they think their relatives might have been buried at a mother and baby home in the Republic of Ireland. A decade ago, it emerged that the nuns who ran the site in County Galway between the 1920s and 60s has disposed of the remains of nearly 800 babies and young children in a disused sewage tank. A new excavation is aiming to identify the victims. In sports, Southampton are still awaiting their first win since their return to the Premier League as they were beaten 3-1 at Bournemouth. The Cherries' first home win of the season came courtesy of three goals in 22 first half minutes. That's through Evan Nielsen, Django Ouattara and Antoine Semenyo. Taylor Harwood-Bennis pulled a goal back in the second half for Saints, who remain 19th with five defeats from six games, while Bournemouth move up to 11th. Manchester United look set to stick with manager Erik ten Hag for matches against Porto and Aston Villa this week. That's despite their demoralising defeat against Tottenham at Old Trafford yesterday. No official comment has been made by the club, but a number of senior sources at United have told BBC Sport that it's business as usual. NBA Hall of Famer Dikembe Mutombo has died from brain cancer at the age of 58. The eight-time NBA All-Star, who retired in 2009, spent 18 years playing in the league. Standing 7'2" tall, Mutombo led the NBA in block shots for five consecutive seasons and blocks per game for a record three consecutive seasons. And Renault says it will end its Formula One engine programme after the 2025 season. That decision means that Renault's Alpine team will have to buy engines from another manufacturer, which is expected to be Mercedes from 2026.
The Football Daily Podcast
on BBC Sounds.
I'm Joel Hart and I'm here at Liverpool's training ground interviewing the great Alison Becker.
I have three kids. They like to be on the goal when they play with me.
Do you see talent?
Yeah, I can see a little bit, but I would love to have a striker in the family.
Alison is up from the back and it comes. Oh, would you believe it?
And this club, I think we have this prophetic sentence, you never walk alone, is always a reminder for me. The people are on my side.
On the Football Daily podcast, you can hear the full interview as we talk all things goalkeeping and what it takes to be the number one at one of the world's biggest clubs.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK, on digital radio,
on BBC Sounds,
and ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Nick Bright.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yeah, evening everybody, it's Nick in for Gordon. Tonight and tomorrow we will be talking to our midnight musicologist Joe Bennett, Dr. Joe Bennett shortly. We'll get our first look at the quiz as well, which I always look forward to whenever I cover for Gordon, even though I am terrible at it. But yeah, we'll talk to Joe shortly. But now this, because today marked the end of an era as the country's last coal power station at Ratcliffe-on-Soar near Nottingham finished operations. It marks the UK's first major economy to stop burning coal to generate electricity. Sorry, it makes the UK the first major economy to stop burning coal to generate electricity and ends 142 years of the UK burning coal for energy. Earlier, I discussed the significance with the historian and author of Why the Industrial Revolution Happened in Britain, Professor Jeremy Black. And I asked him how coal and the Industrial Revolution shaped our society.
Right. Well, obviously, industry becomes proportionately more important. I mean, there's already industry in Britain, industry developed in particular as a result of water power. There's already industry in Britain, but the scale of it changes with coal-powered manufacturing. And you get towns, cities, that had been, let's say, very small in 1700, places like Ebbw Vale in Wales, or indeed Bradford in Yorkshire. And these become much larger places. Ebbw Vale, coal production, iron working. Bradford becomes machine working of Worstead. You know, these become very major places. And what they do is they change the, as it were, flavour of British life. You get large numbers of people moved into urban areas in order to, you know, provide manufactured labour. And they voluntarily move, I mean, because they want the work. So you've got actually a relative degree of prosperity. If you had a steady job, you had relative prosperity. I mean, a city like Sunderland, where shipbuilding begins at great scale, in the early 19th century and becomes one of the greatest shipbuilding cities of the world. Sunderland, most of the workers own their own houses by the late 19th century. So there's obviously a lot of urban poverty, but there's also a lot of urban wealth. And of course, a lot by moving to the cities, by moving away from the countryside, people move into a society that is less deferential, less hierarchical, more a matter of what they can, as it were, achieve with their own ability and labour. And social mobility is much higher in towns than in the countryside. So in many senses, the Industrial Revolution contributes greatly to a modernisation, if you want to use that term, of English society.
Yeah, and then I'm guessing that the political implications and impact were soon felt after as well.
Well, yes. I mean, although it's worth bearing in mind that it doesn't necessarily, I mean, obviously we move towards a male democracy, but female democracy doesn't come on equal level till 1929. So it doesn't all happen at once. But yeah, I think it's very fair to say that society changes. I mean, this comes from Charles Dickens's novel Bleak House, which he published in 1852-3. It came out as a monthly, originally in magazines. He wrote as follows. The iron country, coal pits and ashes, high chimneys and red bricks, blighted verdure, that means greenery, scorching fires and a heavy, never lightning cloud of smoke becomes the features of the scenery. The black canal bridge of a busy town with a clang of iron in it, an iron taste, an iron smell, and a babel of iron sounds. Now, many people were very uncertain about that, but of course what it was the smell of jobs, and that was very important. Population was rising. If you couldn't generate the jobs, people emigrated, and of course a fair number of people did emigrate to places like Australia, Canada, the United States. Agriculture was being hit hard by the late 19th century by food imports from much more cheap producing areas. The, you know, the mutton of Australia, the lamb of New Zealand, the wheat of America, the wheat of Canada, the beef of Argentina. And what that meant was there were people moving off the land. The land wasn't supplying the opportunities. So they had a choice between providing or obtaining industrial jobs in the cities or emigrating. And in a sense, industrialization, obviously we know it had its, you know, its problems, and we're well aware of that these days. We're more aware of environmental issues. But it also was very important to a degree of social mobility, but yet at the same time, social stability. I mean, the 1850s, 1860s, for example, very low unemployment rates, really quite high prosperity, precisely because at that stage, Britain is leading the world in industrialization.
Yeah, really fascinating and interesting stuff there from Professor Jeremy Black. And as I say, Why the Industrial Revolution Happened in Britain, written by Jeremy. Definitely worth checking out if that is your bag. Right, we have our unmissable weekly midnight musicology appointment coming up with Professor Joe Bennett from the Berklee College of Music in Boston. Joe, it's been a while, but it's great to be back with you.
Nick, so good to speak to you again. Yes, it has indeed been a while. So, yeah, good to see you in tonight. We always have a good chat about music, and I love how you throw your musical general knowledge at it. I always collect extra facts when you come back at me in the show.
When I'm sat with somebody like you, I mean, my general knowledge is pretty useless, but I always try. Right, last week, I believe it was all about songs called Breathe. I mean, what musical journey are you taking us on later for this week?
Well, with a little trepidation, maybe, you and I are going to the possibly dangerous territory of talking about controversial music.
Uh-oh.
Songs that have been banned, and also, dare I say, on the BBC, songs that have been banned by the BBC is what we're going to be talking about tonight in many cases. So a whole history of how pop music has had something of a history of being able to upset people, or that the powers that be in various societies have thought pop music might be problematic and tried to stop people hearing it. And it's a really interesting project, this, researching this one, because it tells a kind of social history of the UK and the US as you look at these songs and why they were banned.
I'm guessing they're not still banned, you know, have to check for editorial purposes.
I have actually read the BBC's editorial guidelines for 2024, and I don't think we're going to be contravening any of those on the show. We're looking specifically historically tonight.
Right.
Sigh of relief for the radio presenter.
I bet that was a fun read, the editorial guidelines.
There's a lot of it. Yeah, there's a lot of text.
Right, so how does this fit in then with this week's music quiz?
Well, we are going to go with songs that have been banned, either in the UK or in other locations, or otherwise controversial. And I'm going to give you the year. I'm going to give you a broad area of why this song was banned, and I'm going to give you an instrumental section from the intro. There's a few of them. There's 8 questions, and I think some are really easy and some are really tricky. But this first one, this little taster I'm going to give you, Nick, this one I think is sort of medium easy, certainly if you know your 70s rock. So here we go. This is a little bit of a preview of the quiz. This song came out in 1977 and was banned by the BBC for its political lyric content. Here comes the intro. I'm not giving you any lyrics. That's all you get.
Great song. No, great. I do know that one, but I won't,
excellent.
Spoil it for anyone, but a great song. I'm looking forward to this. This is going to be a great list of tunes, I'm sure, but also a great quiz, Joe.
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to tax some people tonight.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Well, listen, Joe, we'll let you put your feet up for the time being, and we'll be back with you just after midnight. That is Joe Bennett, our midnight musicologist. And as I say, just after midnight, we will be back for that, the rest of that quiz, but also just a great playlist of tunes. It's essential listening, if you ask me. I mean, if you are into your music and this you've stumbled across us somehow, I'd implore you to go back using BBC Sounds previous Mondays. You can listen to Joe and Gordon going through different themes. It's really, really is brilliant. Right, it's almost quarter to midnight. There have been a number of huge explosions in the southern suburbs of Beirut tonight, and smoke has been seen rising near the city's airport as evidence mounts that Israel is preparing to launch a ground offensive against Hezbollah. Tanks have been massing on Israel's northern border with Lebanon, and three areas are being declared closed military zones. The Israeli military warned residents to evacuate southern Beirut ahead of planned strikes on Hezbollah targets. The Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh has been telling the BBC what Washington knew of Israel's planned operations in Lebanon.
We understand what they're doing along that northern border is conducting limited operations to dismantle Hezbollah infrastructure. What the secretary continues to urge for is to seek a diplomatic solution. We certainly want to see regional tensions cool. We see that the best path forward is through diplomatic means, and so that's what we're continuing to push for.
So what chance is there for a deal to be struck? Well, Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former US State Department official and advisor on Arab-Israeli negotiations to both Republican and Democratic administrations, and joins me now. Thank you for coming on, first and foremost. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
What will be going on behind the scenes right now? You know, if you could take us behind the curtain from what you know.
I think that's not the main event. The main event is what you see in front of the scenes. And I think over the last 2 weeks, it's pretty clear what Israel's objective is, which is to fundamentally degrade Hamas's capacity. See if it could erode its stockpiles of high-trajectory weapons, decimate its communication system, kill its senior leaders, and ultimately they succeeded in killing Hassan Nasrallah. The question is, what is the Israeli objectives? Is it to continue to pound and degrade Hezbollah, or are the Israelis looking for a diplomatic off-ramp? If they are, then there is the possibility, but again, that will depend on decisions on Hezbollah's part, and perhaps even a decision on the part of Yahya Sinwar, who is the Palestinian leader, who's ensconced in a tunnel somewhere, meters below ground, probably surrounded by hostages, dead and alive. Whether or not those three parties, and of course the fourth, Iran, are willing to support a diplomatic offer right now, I think, is right now a bridge too far. I just have no idea whether Hezbollah has the command and control to make decisions, whether Iran has a strategy, a plan B, now that its primary proxy in Lebanon has been decimated. And it's hard to read the Israelis on this, hard to see how you translate the tactical successes they've had into a situation where the Lebanese border, from the internationally recognized border to the Litani River, is free from Hezbollah forces and weaponry. That would require the implementation of either the Lebanese army, the UNIFIL, which is the UN force for Lebanon, which is powerless in the face of Hezbollah's military strength, to basically assume a broader role. So we're talking about a diplomatic off-ramp in a significant way that is weeks, if not months away. Plus, of course, within 45 days, you've got one of the most consequential elections in modern American history. And to focus on this while everyone is focused on that is a tough one.
that's a huge factor, isn't it? The outcome of the U.S. presidential election, specifically, but obviously globally, it's a huge factor in anything. But just specifically with regards to this conflict, because it feels a little bit like, because President Biden is outgoing no matter what, is he almost like a bit of a lame duck in a way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and much can be done and has been done in discrete instances during a lame duck administration. But that assumes a friendly transfer of power. In 1988, the outgoing Reagan administration, I was a part of this, ended up cutting a deal with the incoming Bush 41 administration on the issue of getting the PLO to recognize Israel. And you had the beginning of a US-PLO dialogue in 1990. All that was done during the 3 or 4 months from the election of George H.W. Bush to the inauguration. Here, it's much more complicated. You're talking about major players, a lot of moving pieces. And again, it's unclear, frankly, what the Israeli endgame is here, and whether or not Hezbollah has the capacity, even if they were so inclined, to make a decision. And then you have the Lebanese government, of course, which has been over the years weakened by the presence of Hezbollah's military power and Iranian influence. Whether or not there's an opportunity on behalf of the international community to buck up the Lebanese government, perhaps some of the other confessional groups, the Christians, the Sunnis, the Druze, will see opportunities to increase their own power and their own status as Hezbollah weakens. So again, I mean, what I see out there, frankly, is a lot of uncertainty. This is very early days in terms of imagining how any of this is going to end.
Yeah, I mean, is it harder now? I mean, it definitely sounds it based on, you know, what you were saying there, but just harder right now to see a diplomatic solution, a diplomatic route compared with previous years?
I mean, I do think that's the case because, look, you've got 4 decision makers right now. You've got Yahya Sinwar, who is holding hostages ensconced in a tunnel somewhere in Gaza. You've got Benjamin Netanyahu, who puts his own political survival and maintenance of power, which means catering to the extreme right in his coalition. You've got whoever this successor is, Hashim Safieddine, who's the new, once he's elected, I gather, by the Shura Council, the new head of Hezbollah. Who knows, you know, what kind of credibility and stature he has. And then you've got the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, right, the supreme leader of Iran, who has just seen Iran's major proxy, its asset, which it spent billions of dollars over the last, since the early 80s, building up, being decimated. And you have to wonder, you know, those weapons in Lebanon were there for one reason, and it wasn't to liberate Palestine. They were there as a contingency in the event the U.S. and or Israel struck Iranian nuclear sites. That's not an insurance policy anymore for the Iranians. It could cause them to de-escalate, or alternatively, they're already a nuclear weapons threshold state. In other words, they have all the ingredients, the know-how, the fissile material to actually produce a weapon. It could, perhaps, given the fact that Hezbollah deterrent has been so badly mauled, they could think that the real deterrent for them is weaponization. But that, of course, entails the risk of courting not just an Israeli military strike, but the commitment of 5 U.S. presidents who declared that Iran will not possess a nuclear weapon. So again, you know, the media, normal humans don't like uncertainty. But I'm afraid it's the Middle East after all, right? So you have to learn to live with it because, again, it's early days and there's going to be a lot of twists and turns in this one before it's clear. Headlines are clear. The trend lines are not clear.
Is this the closest we've been to all-out war in the region to this scale?
No. I could sketch out for you a way we could get there. But, you know, the Iranians are on their back foot now. Hezbollah no longer has the capacity, it seems. And if they did threaten Israel with their precision-guided missiles, the Israelis would respond in a way that would be so massive. Thousands of Lebanese would die. Hundreds of Israelis, too. Hezbollah would launch these missiles, assuming they still have the capacity to do so into urban centers and against major Israeli infrastructure. So you could see this ramping up, but I'm not sure that's where we're going. And I think that this has created more pause, more, I think, a moment of not action, but thinking through what are the options of the various parties rather than rushing to confrontation. The only party that appears ready to act, you're going to see a ground incursion, I suspect, limited. But again, you know, once you start a ground incursion, does it stay limited? I mean, we're talking about a mountainous forested region where Hezbollah has had 18 years, you know, to create all kinds of tunnel infrastructure and find a way to play games by moving mobile missiles around. And Israelis could encounter a fair number of casualties. This could not be as easy as they – I mean, I don't think they think it's easy, but it could be worse than they think. So, again, sorry to have to do this, but it's just another piece of the puzzle right now. And I think that's the way, a good metaphor to look at it that way. You got all these pieces to the puzzle, which until the last 2 weeks fit a pretty good mold. I mean, you could see where the puzzle was. Now the pieces are all scrambled. And I don't think the parties themselves, let alone the analysts like me, see how they easily fit together. So that means living with an unassembled, metaphorically speaking, jigsaw puzzle on your living room floor. The pieces will maybe come together in the weeks and months ahead, but they're not all going to fit. So that's going to create even more uncertainty.
And there's layers to it as well, of course, with, you know, two conflicts, maybe three if you include the Houthis in Yemen.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
You know, it's not easy to predict what's going to happen here.
No, it's not.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Aaron, thank you for your time. Aaron David Miller, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former US State Department official and advisor on Arab-Israeli negotiations to both Republican and Democratic administrations. Right, we are flying towards our midnight musicologist. Joe Bennett will be back with me in around 4 minutes' time. But after us, Dotun Adebayo takes over. Hello, mate.
Hi, mate. Listen, I've been listening to what you were just talking to Aaron about, and obviously the crisis in the Middle East will dominate, as you would expect, our consideration. If we do hear word of a Israeli ground incursion into Lebanon by the many tanks that we've seen amassed on its border over the next few hours, we'll bring you the news first here on 5 Live. So it's one of those nights, as you know, Nick, sometimes in this game you can plan as much as you like, but events, dear boy, do happen. And if those events happen, we'll be there for you. So don't worry. Don't worry. We'll keep you across that. Meanwhile, though, what we have planned for is a World Football phone-in tonight. Do you mind me asking you, not disrespectfully, because, of course, if I had your youth and you had my wisdom, what a wonderful world it would be. But do you know who Dennis Bergkamp is?
You're asking me, an Arsenal fan who's almost 40, by the way, well, if I know who Dennis Bergkamp is.
You're still a youth. But yeah, I'm asking you.
In my opinion, this may be controversial, but I always say, in my opinion, the best player to wear the red and white of Arsenal.
As you know, I'm from the other side of North London, but I must admit, when I bumped into Dennis Bergkamp at my local gym, I said to him, look, I hate the Gooners, but I've got to shake your hand, man. Enough respect.
Yeah.
And I said that to Emmanuel Petit when I bumped into him at Nice Airport as well. So every Gooner that I bump into, I say, look, I do hate you Gooners, but hey, you are a decent player. However, the reason I'm asking is because you heard what Cole Palmer said the other day after scoring, was it 4 goals for Chelsea?
Yeah.
Interviewed on Match of the Day, they asked him about, they made a comparison with Dennis Bergkamp, and he said, look, yeah, I've heard of him, but I've never seen him play.
It's a shocker.
Well, you say it's a shocker, but this is 20, 25 years later, mate.
Show him that goal against Newcastle where he passed it to himself.
We still don't know how he did that. I think it was trick photography, by the way. But nevertheless, the question we're asking on tonight's World Football Phone-In is, who is the one player from your generation that the now generation, the youngsters today, including the footballers, yes, top flight footballers today, the youngest today, need to know about? And why do they need to know about that particular football? That's what we're doing. World Football Phone, it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, brilliant topic. I'm sure there'll be loads of suggestions and responses for
Loads of young gooners saying, who is Dennis Bergkamp?
No, don't say that. You're breaking my heart every time you say it.
Of course that doesn't make sense. Yeah. I know. And if Cole Palmer had been a gooner, he'd know who Dennis Bergkamp was. But it was an honest answer, you know. Yeah. And like I say, if you youngers had my brains and I had your youth, what a wonderful world it would be, Nick. What
a dangerous world. Well, listen, Dotton, looking forward to that. I'll be tuned in on the way home. Dotton coming your way at 1 o'clock. Right, just a bit of breaking news for you. The Reuters news agency is reporting that the Israeli military has begun limited, localised and targeted raids against Hezbollah targets in the border area of southern Lebanon. And Dotton, of course, will keep you across all the breaking news, as he just said, when he takes over at 1 o'clock. Right, as I said, Joe Bennett, our midnight musicologist, is on the way, and it's songs that have been banned. It's going to be a good one. We'll get into it after the news. It's midnight.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Matthew Carter. There are mounting signs that Israel is preparing to launch a ground offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Tanks have been massing on Israel's northern border, and three areas there have been declared closed military zones. The UK has announced that a chartered commercial flight will leave Beirut on Wednesday to help any British nationals wanting to leave Lebanon. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson has the latest from the Israel-Lebanon border.
Israel's army has sealed off several areas towards the eastern end of the border, and the US State Department has confirmed that Israel has been carrying out what it says are limited raids on Hezbollah infrastructure along the border. But there are growing signs that a wider Israeli invasion is imminent, if not underway, and with all the regional risks that entails.
Emergency workers in the US are trying to locate people who remain unaccounted for 3 days after Hurricane Helene tore through the southeastern American states. Officials at the Department of Homeland Security fear that as many as 600 people may have died. Mike Cooper lives in North Carolina, the state's worst hit by the storm.
We just went out to do a recce and see what things were like beyond the end of our valley. There are hour-long lines for people trying to get into petrol gas stations to get their vehicles fueled. It's a mess. And the problem is that whereas somewhere like Florida that's more set up for this and is fairly level and things drain away quickly, we have a lot of mountain roads that have been washed out. So that will hamper efforts to repair this and will slow things down substantially.
The UK's top civil servant, Simon Case, has said he'll leave the role at the end of the year, citing health issues. Mr. Case was appointed by Boris Johnson in 2020, but recent reports suggested tension between him and the new Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Sue Gray. Members of the largest education union have voted overwhelmingly to accept the government's latest pay offer. The National Education Union had already recommended that teachers in England should accept a 5.5% increase. Schools will receive an additional £1.2 billion to fund the pay rise. The BBC has partially upheld complaints made by the actress Amanda Abington against her professional partner.